Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to say good evening and welcome to the Conservative Speakers Club. For those who don't know me, my name is Betty Lukes, and one of the hats I wear is as the Secretary of the Conservative Speakers Club. Our usual chairman has a night off tonight. He's gone to see the river dance, and I'm quite annoyed about that. Not so much that I have to chair the meeting, but he's gone to see the river dance. So it is my pleasure tonight to chair the meeting, and it's certainly my pleasure to introduce our speaker, and it's Dr. Horst Pohlmann. And Dr. Pohlmann has a PhD of medicine in oncology, and he is highly qualified in complementary medicine, and also is an international lecturer at medical conventions, and recently he has lectured in Europe and India and the USA. I see by his card he practices homeopathy, acupuncture, and a natural therapist. And I guess that as the evening goes on, you will learn more of his qualifications. But when I read in the Adelaide Advertiser the headline, "No Jab, No Welfare," my blood pressure was raised. And the idea was, of course, that the health authorities were going to use the welfare money big stick on parents who did not immunize their children. And I saw it that, as a mother and a grandmother, that this raised many fundamental questions. And I know from my own experience that mothers generally are very concerned for the health and welfare of their children. And I didn't believe the reports that were coming in to say that the parents were apathetic and were not having their children immunized because they were apathetic. I simply didn't believe it. And so I started to make inquiries, and of course from seeing what's been happening even within my own family, I realized that there was quite a big question mark on this question of immunization now. And so I was really delighted when Dr. Pohlmann said that he would be willing to speak on the subject to the Conservative Speakers Club. So without any more words from me, I'd just like to say welcome to Dr. Pohlmann, who's going to speak on compulsory immunization. Is it ethical? Is it safe? Thank you, Dr. Pohlmann.
Good evening. Thank you very much for welcoming me. I think I have to tell you a few things. Some of them might shock you. Some of them might spoil your belief in the teachings of the medical profession. And some of you might think twice about other claims that are made by the medical profession. And I think you should really evaluate very carefully whatever is told as preventing diseases. As I said this evening, if the Holden Company would suddenly start a campaign against motor cars, you would start thinking, why would they spoil their own business? And if a profession that lives from disease would suddenly have some means of preventing disease, you would ask yourself, why would they do a thing like that? I think that should be right. Yeah. So what I'm trying to tell you today is the history of vaccination, which is quite a long history, the results, and the side effects of the vaccination. Now, the history was that a English surgeon, Mr. Jenner, you know, when a doctor becomes a surgeon, he becomes a mister again, and I said, well, maybe because he forgets everything about medicine then. And he observed, or he thought he observed, that farm people who had contact with cows that had cowpox didn't usually get the smallpox. And he thought there must be some sort of a immunization through the contact. He didn't understand that they simply lived healthier than the people in the cities. And that's the reason why they got the disease not as common as the people in the cities. But from then on, they started to take the pus of those pustules from the cowpox and inoculated it into people. And because the Latin word for cow is vacca, it was the beginning of the term vaccination. That means coming from the cow. Now, of course, many, I'll tell you a little bit later what those vaccinations are made from. They're not made from cows anymore. At least most of them are not anymore. It's much more terrible what they put in there. And then if you ever had it, I think you still feel very bad that you had a thing like that put into your body. Now, the first vaccination program that was done all over the world was, of course, the smallpox vaccination. And so we have the best results on smallpox vaccination. And we know that in every country where they vaccinated, there were the most violent outbreaks of smallpox. Whenever they were vaccinated, and the more people were vaccinated, the more violent the outbreaks were. That means at the time when basically 99% of the population in Great Britain was vaccinated, they had the most deadly and violent outbreaks of smallpox in the UK. Now, this is something that happens with every vaccination. That means what you get when you vaccinate is you get the disease much more violent and much more deadly. Unfortunately, I haven't got an overhead projector. Otherwise, I could have shown you graphs of what happens when you vaccinate. Now, what's the theory behind all that? There was once a French inorganic chemist, and he was a person that liked to stand in the limelight. He wanted to be famous, but he didn't know anything about medicine. And so he did it. He was not the first one, but a very successful man in plagiarizing a real researcher's work, Antoine Béchamp. Antoine Béchamp was a highly qualified microbiologist, if something like that happened. Existed in the middle of the 19th century. And Antoine Béchamp's work is still extremely valuable. If you read his books in our days, he knew a lot more than at least 10,000 medical specialists together. Now, Pasteur, being not a doctor, didn't understand his research. And he also plagiarized the work of an earlier scientist from Italy and came up with the silly idea that germs cause diseases. And this silly idea is the reason why medicine is now in the dark Middle Ages. Because everything is an infection. Everything. And viruses and germs are our enemies. And they make us sick, so we have to kill them. And if we kill them, we get healthy again. That is what we are all taught. I was taught that nonsense as well. And of course, we all know that this is not true. We all know it. Because if a mother takes care of the child that has got pneumonia, if the germ would cause the disease, the mother must get pneumonia. But she doesn't get it. We all know that. If the doctors work in hospital, they all must get sick because they're exposed to germs all the time. Why aren't they? So we all know this theory is wrong, but we still keep repeating it. And I always quote a infamous politician, Mr. Schicklgruber, who said, if you repeat a lie long enough and often enough, even the ones who know better will start to believe it. You don't know Mr. Schicklgruber?
Yes.
Yes, you know. So this inorganic chemist said germs cause diseases. And he also had the idea that there must be some sort of immunization against those germs. And so he did laboratory tests. Actually, about 2 years ago, if I remember that right, Pasteur's books, laboratory books, were sold. And in those, you found that he did very well. He taught these researchers very well, because what didn't show up in the experiment was just claimed that it happened. He corrected the results of his experiments, so they fitted his theories. And this is the way medicine still works, even in our days. He was the demigod of medicine, and everybody followed him. So the world was admiring this great scientist, but when he at the end discovered the truth himself and said it, they didn't want to know it anymore. Because it's reported that Pasteur himself said, "I was wrong. It's the soil and not the germ that makes the plant grow." And I mean, we all know that if you put grass seeds of the best quality in the Simpson Desert, it will certainly not grow a lawn there. And if you put the seeds from the plants in the desert into your garden, they won't grow either, because the environment is wrong. So the germ theory is not really right. What we also know since Bichon, since 1870, that germs actually develop in a media out of something else. And at the time when the standard of medicine was the highest in the 1920s to 1930s, they actually could prove that germs alter, they become another germ depending on the environment. And the famous researcher Royal Rife, he was famous to the ones who know about him, but most doctors have never heard the name, because the AMA and the FDA were very careful to wipe out all traces of his existence, because he spoiled the game. He could actually prove that the germs that live in everybody's healthy bowels become Salmonella typhi if you alter the toxicity of the environment by 2 parts per million. Escherichia coli, coli means only of the bowels, Escherichia coli alters into Salmonella typhi by changing the environment, the toxicity, by 2 parts per million. That means you don't have to get the germ from the outside. It comes from within you. If you reduce the toxicity, it becomes the normal healthy germ again. But if you alter the toxicity any further, you get Mycobacterium tuberculosum from Salmonella typhi. And if you alter the toxicity more, if you get more toxic, this same Mycobacterium tuberculosum becomes a yeast form, the famous Candida albicans. And if you just get more toxic, it becomes a germ which Royal Rife termed the BX, the bacterium X, which causes cancer. Now this is something the medical profession does not want to accept. Not that they don't know it, they don't want to accept. Now when I talk about the medical profession, also further down the track, this is not the doctors that do their daily job in their practice. To make this quite clear, they are misled as much as you are. And they believe it because the authority said it. When I talk about the doctors, I talk about the people high up in the hierarchy, the people on top, not the ones that do the slave labor and work hard and really believe what they're doing. Now what happens if you have got a salmonella infection and you give a halogenated antibiotic, fluoridated or chlorinated, mainly fluoridated, you jump over all the intermediate stages and they're right at the BX virus, which causes cancer. It's that simple. And you ask a few people, just ask 20 people who have cancer, a lot of them will tell you, at least 4 or 5, oh yes, we were on a course of antibiotics for a long time before the cancer was discovered. So antibiotic does what the name says. Antibios means against life. It kills. It certainly does kill. Now, so not to need antibiotics, they had the idea of weakening a natural germ or taking parts of a germ, inject it into the body by bypassing all the defense mechanisms with a hypodermic needle and expect the body to produce so-called antibodies. Now, an antibody is a protein, mainly a globulin, that has a specific key to dock onto a germ and can destroy it. And this antigen-antibody mechanism is described well in the literature. What they didn't describe is this mechanism doesn't work if there are not certain prerequisites that are fulfilled. So even if you have the antibody and you have the germ, the central nervous system has to say, okay, you go and do. And it doesn't help you if you're full of antibodies if the okay from the central nervous system is missing. They're totally useless. They just float around and do nothing. And this is why vaccinations don't work. Exactly that mechanism. You can prove the existence of antibodies, but they do nothing because the port of entry was different. The germ didn't come through a hypodermic needle. It came a different way. So your system doesn't know that it has antibodies, and it can't activate them. Now, let's see what happens. How do you make such a concoction? Later on, I give you an interview, admittedly not a real one, but Peter Sawyer, which some of you might have heard the name, he once produced a wonderful pamphlet on vaccinations, and he also wrote up an interview between a parent and a doctor, an honest doctor who told the truth when he was asked. And I will give that to you at the end. It tells you what they make the vaccines from. But I also give you some other stories how they make vaccines, because not all of them are done the same way. But there is one thing for sure, and this is what the figures prove, that it doesn't matter whether you're vaccinated or not. You still get the disease. Doesn't really matter at all. It only might look slightly different and might be more deadly. So if you vaccinate your child against measles, the measles might look atypical, and the clever doctor might call it something different. They're still measles, but they're much more likely to end up deadly than the natural measles. And the same happens with many, many other vaccinations. There is no such thing as a vaccination. This is what I want to tell you today. There is no immunization against infectious diseases. It is at the best wishful thinking. At the very best, it is wishful thinking. But there might be other reasons behind that as well. So the idea was to inject that live germ, that live virus, if there is a thing like a live virus, which I doubt very much, that attenuated germ, or that part of a germ, or the toxin of a germ, you inject into the bloodstream and you expect the body to form so-called antibodies. Now, if you expect the body to form antibodies, you must have a functioning immune system. Otherwise, the body cannot possibly form antibodies. And the immune system of a child up to the year, up to the in the first year, is certainly not capable of producing antibodies. That's why they vaccinate the children in the first 3 months. A lot of sense, isn't it? So you inject something that is supposed to form antibodies into an organism that is not capable of forming antibodies. Very clever. So you do that several times, but what is in that vaccine? Well, I told you some things. Maybe a live germ, attenuated germ, particles of a germ, but what is that? Well, that is genetic material. This is genetic material, DNA, desoxyribonucleic acid. That means hereditary factors. Inject hereditary factors by bypassing all defense mechanisms into the bloodstream of a child that is not able to defend itself against that. Now what happens? That genetic material attaches to the body cells. Now they're different. They're not the body cells anymore because they have other genetic material attached to it. But those cells still multiply. And the cells multiply, but they're alien cells. So the body's defense system will start attacking them, which leads to autoimmune disease. Nobody thinks of that. That means you're creating chronic polyarthritis, pancreatitis, and other things in an early age in a newborn baby, which will only show up when there are enough cells after multiplication in a certain age, which then will destroy, the immune system will start destroying the own organism. It doesn't show up straight away. Well, this is one effect. But what else is in there? Some formaldehyde, some mercury, some lead, some preservatives. It's also in there. Some aluminium oxide, aluminium hydroxide, all substances are known to be poisonous. Now, why would we think that we have to poison a newborn baby? Why would we come up with such a silly idea? And what happens then? The children that are vaccinated against measles get atypical measles, but not once. They get them 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 times. Because they don't build up an immunity anymore. And they even get the real measles, and they might die of them. Now, of course, this is not usually told. The story is not usually told. So I will give you a story that happened that not too long ago, when the then health minister, Carmen Lawrence, wrote in the Weekend Australian, I think, that there was a measles outbreak in Queensland and that several children had died, and therefore she urged parents to have their children vaccinated against measles. And you won't believe it. There was a person that didn't believe it. And this person went up there and made inquiries. Not only did nobody in that town know anything about the measles outbreak, none of the children were missing from school. They hadn't had measles for years there. Now she said, well, what about the dead children? And she found the parents, and the parents said, yes, well, it is true. Several years ago, our children died of measles, shortly after they had been vaccinated against measles. Now that, of course, was not written in the newspaper, that the dead children were the vaccinated ones. Now why would the health minister lie? Have you got any idea? Why would Carmen Lawrence lie in the newspaper about the measles outbreak in Queensland that didn't happen? About children dying because they weren't vaccinated, when in fact they were the vaccinated ones that died? And do you really think she hasn't got access to the same figures and facts which I have? Which are the figures from the United States, from the United Kingdom, from France, from Germany, about the effects of vaccinations? You really think a health minister has got no access to that? Or the head of the medical profession wouldn't have? I think it was a Mr. Shepherd in those days leading the sheep. Well, isn't that what a shepherd is? Looking after the sheep? Well, there are a few things we should think about. Now, what happens when you vaccinate, not only doesn't it prevent that you get the disease, it also makes it much more deadly. That means if you contract the disease after the vaccination, your chances of dying of the disease are a lot higher than they are without the vaccination. Now, this is also very interesting, but it is a fact. As I said, unfortunately, I haven't got an overhead projector. But maybe you can see the top graph. Now, this, the top graph, if you can see it, refers to polio vaccination. This line is the beginning of vaccination. And this actually means little coffins. That means children that had died of polio. Now this starts in 1958, I think. And you see that the number of children dying of polio reduced continuously until they started vaccination. And then you see how the number of dead children rapidly grew. That was the effect of vaccination. They didn't die less, or they didn't even get less polio. They just died more often. Now, here, in the lower graph, that's the beginning of the vaccination. And this is the number of children who got polio. Well, that certainly doesn't look like a decrease. Not to me, anyhow. It looks like a severe increase, fourfold increase of the disease. Now, I mean, why do I pay money to get the disease? Why do the government spend money that four times more children get polio than without spending the money? Thank you. Now, this graph shows something very similar. I don't know if you can see it, but you can see that when, in the moment vaccination started, the number of complications in polio severely increased. Now, also that should make you think. Who's lying? I mean, these are figures based on the official statistics of the United States. Thank you. Now, I have to tell you a little other trick. Before vaccination was introduced, all symptoms of polio were recorded, even transitory symptoms that only lasted for hours. After the vaccination was introduced, polio was only recorded when it lasted longer than 6 weeks. And even with that lie or that trick, they weren't able to prove any benefits of vaccination. Now you can imagine if they wouldn't have used the trick, how badly that would have looked like. I think it wouldn't be high enough here on the ceiling that I could show you the graph. Now what's behind that? The government paid for the rhesus monkeys, because I will tell you a little bit later how they make this vaccine, or the Salk vaccine. And so the manufacturer paid about 3 cents for an ampule. mainly the instruments and the glass for the ampule, and they sold the ampule for $1. It's a good profit. And if you look at the five companies, by coincidence, they were all Rockefeller-controlled companies. Big coincidence, yes. You can see that all those companies doubled their profit within 1 year, selling the salk vaccine. Well, that could be a good reason for vaccination, wouldn't it? But what happened is that they had about 20,000 little coffins in the United States every year, dead children as a result of the polio vaccination. 20,000 per year. I mean, admittedly, the United States are a little bit bigger, but still a lot. And that went on for years, and suddenly it stopped. Suddenly there was no more increase, there was a decrease, and apparently the vaccine got safe. And there was a Mr. Miller, a chemist, who had challenged the medical profession several times by saying, "I don't believe your silly germ theory," and he even offered that Mr. Salk himself was invited to inject some infected blood from a polio child into his vein just to prove the point that it is not contagious. Of course, they didn't do it. They knew very well why. But this Mr. Miller went out with a sales representative of one of those companies, and when they had a little bit too much of the wine, of Miami's wine, the sales representative told him the truth. He said, "Well, look, actually, we're selling now just red water, so it's totally safe." So the salk vaccine from then on was just colored water. Then, of course, it was safe. Polio kept declining, as it did anyhow, because polio has got a certain pattern. It comes every 200 years. It reaches a peak and then disappears without vaccination or with vaccination. Only with vaccination, it disappears a lot more slowly than without vaccination. And in the United States, actually, they had a very interesting appearance that basically all people who had polio in the last few years, there were, for instance, 45 in 1 year, they were all somehow connected with somebody who had a vaccination. The others that were not exposed didn't get polio. Interesting. But what happened? When the first deaths were reported from polio vaccination, Dr. Scheel, the head of the United States Public Health Service, USPHS, said, "It seems likely, though not immediately provable, that those deaths were significantly associated with the salk vaccination." But on the same evening, the same man said on radio, "I have confidence in the salk vaccine. I urge doctors to continue vaccinations." He has a very short memory. The first one was Alzheimer's disease, wasn't he? Within a few hours, he changed his mind. Now, a witness who actually observed the production of the salk vaccine in the laboratory, he says, "They would take a helpless little monkey, tie it onto a vivisection table, and inject the chemical into the blood, which paralyzes the hind legs and the function of the kidneys. The monkey's kidneys and all the poisons caused by this chemical were taken out and poured into a retort, mixed with other chemicals, and put into ampules. This was called salk vaccine." There was quite a bit of monkey blood in the kidneys, which accounts for the fact that the salk concoction had a reddish color. Gives you a bit of an idea how they make vaccines, how they made it in 1958. Now they are much more sophisticated. They put a lot more in it. So Mr. Sabin, he developed a living vaccine, which is the one you swallow. So Mr. Salt traveled around the world saying how dangerous Mr. Sabin's vaccine is, that it causes death and polio. And Mr. Sabin traveled around the world telling everybody how dangerous Mr. Salk's vaccine is, that it causes death and polio. And because both are highly qualified scientists, I believe them both. Well, you should really believe the authorities, shouldn't you? So I strongly advise not to vaccinate against polio, because first of all, it doesn't prevent the disease in the first place, and second, it's a damn dangerous vaccination. I just talked about what it doesn't do. It does not prevent the disease. I should tell you what it does. It's very effective, actually, because it causes polio. Well, I told you that. But it also causes inflammation of the brain. It causes a breakdown of the immune system called acquired immune deficiency syndrome. You might have heard that term somewhere before. Like all vaccines do, it causes loss of memory, disability, causes children to become paralyzed, lose their intelligence, become violent, hyperactive. That all sound a little bit familiar with what happens to children in our days? Heard of that, didn't you? So the vaccines are really effective. Now I can give you some figures. In 1958, vaccination with the Salk vaccine was introduced in the United States. In the state of North Carolina, there were 74 cases of polio. In 1959, a year later, after compulsory vaccination, there were 313 cases of polio. In Tennessee, there were 119 in 1958. 1959, there were 386. In Connecticut, there were 45 in 1958 and 123 in 1959. Among those, very well documented 35 that were fully immunized against polio. In Ohio, we haven't got the exact figures. We only know that it quadrupled. And this based on a statement of the United States Health Department giving recommendations to the communities saying ignore the light cases, leave them if possible undiagnosed in the hope recovery can be made before paralysis sets in. Hesitate in diagnosis regardless of the symptoms. Trying to think up some new diagnosis to hide the polio cases behind. Now, these were instructions given to the health authorities. Refuse to diagnose as polio cases which have had some kind of shots. That means if a child gets polio that was vaccinated, don't diagnose it as polio. In simple words. Even so, the usual symptoms and the paralysis is present. So lie. And even then it quadrupled. Even then, using all those methods, the number quadrupled. Ignore polio given to the patient by the Salk shots occurring in the hours immediately following the shots, simply calling in reaction. Now these were the instructions given. And as I said, despite that fraud, the number still quadrupled. So you can imagine how, if they would have honestly reported, what would have come out. So there must be something wrong with that idea of vaccination, because we always hear polio disappeared because of vaccination. It is not true. If you see the figures, you see that polio was already on the decline when they finally started vaccination. And it was already very little anyhow from those figures. You see, I mean, North Carolina is not a little village. It's quite a big state. And they had 74 cases of polio. So it can't be a very violent disease. So polio was already nearly gone when they started vaccination, and it was only kept alive with vaccination. Now, Mr. Salk himself, actually, he made a very interesting statement. He said, when you inoculate children with a polio vaccine, you don't sleep well for a week or two. So at least he had some conscience. Think of the 20,000 per year, 20,000 little coffins, thanks to vaccination, which wouldn't have died without the vaccination, because the disease wasn't around anymore. Now, all those things you should keep in mind when you hear those reports on radio on an outbreak of whooping cough in Adelaide. Now, whooping cough you cannot diagnose by symptoms because it appears like a spastic bronchitis, like a sort of asthma. So the only way to diagnose whooping cough is a very specific laboratory test, which is not available in Australia anymore because whooping cough has disappeared due to vaccination. Now, I ask you, how did they diagnose those children with whooping cough in the hospital? That's a miraculous thing to me. It can only be diagnosed with a test that is not available. But they're definite it is whooping cough. Now, there's a research group in